I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 31, A Chat with Leslie Klinger.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astronomer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Bigger Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Well, hello and welcome to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees, where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
And I'm Burt Wolder.
And once again, we welcome you back to our cozy little chamber here on the web, on your iPod, or wherever else you may be listening to us, to join us for a wonderful discussion about what's going on in the world of Sherlock Holmes. First, before we get to the meat of our program, and it is going to be a very meaty one this time, we promise, a quick word about our sponsor, Wessex Press. You can visit Wessex Press online at wessexpress.com. These are the fine folks who have brought you a number of Sherlockian works over the years, including a wonderful anthology called the Sherlock Holmes Reference Library, which was annotated by none other than our guest today. You'll be hearing more about him momentarily, as well as some recent books, most notably The Origins of Sherlockian Scholarship, explored in five works by Ronald Knox. It's called Ronald Knox and Sherlock Holmes, and it's edited by Michael J. Crow. The folks at Wessex Press do a fine job. We really, really appreciate their sponsoring this program to bring it to you. It pays for our hosting costs and other associated costs with regard to running such a program. We thank Wessex Press, and we hope you will thank them as well by visiting their website and purchasing some of their fine books, wessexpress.com.
And I have my copy of Ronald Knox and Sherlock Holmes, The Origin of Sherlockian Studies, here in front of me, and it's a terrific book. It's under one of their imprints, the Gasogene books, but it includes the studies in the literature of Sherlock Holmes, Knox's introduction to the best detective stories of 1928, the mathematics of Mrs. Watson, the mystery of Mycroft, and the adventure of the first class carriage. So if you'd like to participate in the current is it a brouhaha? Is it a contretemps? Maybe it's just an enthusiastic discussion about the origins of Sherlockian studies.
Ain't no frat party, I'll tell you that.
That's right. What better place to start than with the origin of Sherlockian studies from good old Wessex Press?
Yeah, and you know, I think that one of the interesting things is this is a particularly important year in terms of why we're all here doing what we do. Ronald Knox's work, that seminal work, Sherlock Holmes, and the studies in the literature of Sherlock Holmes, appeared or was first given in 1911, exactly 100 years ago. And at the BSI dinner, the Baker Street Irregulars annual dinner this year, we spent a lot of time kind of celebrating that centenary, marking that as kind of the first work that set this off. And I know there's been some debate, and we may actually explore that debate in future episodes in terms of whether this was truly the beginning of Sherlockian scholarship or not. Debate aside, we know it was a seminal work and an important one to celebrate. And it's been one that has been already heralded this year and will continue to be talked about throughout the remainder of 2011.
But What we'll be continued to talk about this evening is our guest. And we're welcoming Les Klinger to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. Les, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
Now, for folks who don't necessarily know who Les Klinger is, let me just read to you his biography off of one of his latest publications, which will give you a nice thumbnail as to some of the things we're going to be talking about in the next few minutes, or hours if you're with us for that long. Les Klinger is the editor of the three-volume set, The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes, published by W.W. Norton in 2004 and 2005. He's also the editor of the 10-volume Sherlock Holmes Reference Library, published by our sponsors, Wessex Press, aimed at the serious student of Sherlock Holmes. Klinger has written numerous books and articles on Sherlockiana and co-edited with Andrew J. Peck the revised edition of The Date Being, a compendium of Sherlockian chronologies with S.E. Dollinger. He has also written Sherlock Holmes, Conan Doyle, and The Bookman, an anthology of literary treasures. And he's taught several UCLA extension courses on Sherlock Holmes and his world. And most interestingly to perhaps listeners of this show, Les is actually consulting with Warner Brothers on what was until just last week the untitled sequel to Sherlock Holmes, now known as Sherlock Holmes,
A Game of Shadows.
That's the one. Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows, which is due out in December of 2011. He's also co-editing an anthology of Victorian detective stories for IDW Publishing. He's written the new annotated Dracula in 2008 and numerous articles about Dracula and vampires. And he's editing an anthology of Victorian vampire stories for IDW as well. Les holds the Two Shilling Award and several editor's medals from the Baker Street Irregulars, where he is invested as the Abbey Grange. And he's the series editor for the BSI Manuscript Series and currently the series editor for the History Series. Finally, Les has edited with Laurie R. King The Grand Game, a two-volume set of a celebration of Sherlockian scholarship, and is also working on a study in Sherlock with Laurie King, a collection of stories about Sherlock Holmes, which is due out later this year. So that takes up about half our show.
That's a great program. Well, until next time.
Great talking to you guys.
That's great having you.
We're a little late, folks, so good night.
So,
on behalf of the Baker Street Irregulars, Les, we would like to ask you just to cut it out. Would you please cut it out?
I've been trying.
Stop it. It's enough. We can only read so quickly.
This all started with my wife saying to me one Saturday when I had asked her for the umpteenth time, "So what are we doing this weekend? Why don't you go write something?" I think that she is regretful a little bit, but not very, because it's done a good job of keeping me out of her hair on the weekends.
You couldn't start with a limerick, a poem, a greeting card.
What I started with was an article for the BSJ about Holmes and wine, two of my favorite subjects.
So. Now, how long ago was that?
That was, I think, 1995, 94, 95, something like that.
Now, I know the work you did with Andy Peck, A Date Being, the Date Being, that's something that was like from the 70s, wasn't it?
Yes, Andy put out, Andy, who was, I think at the time, 18 when that book came out, typed by his mother, he's proud to say, put together a compendium of the then existing chronologies of the canon. There were nine chronologies. And what that original book, which is kind of a very inexpensively produced a spiral-bound pamphlet, is a great table with notes of the nine chronologies showing each of the stories and what the different chronologists said about the dates. What happened was, I mean, Andy's been a friend of mine for more than 30 years, and when I was teaching a course, the first time I taught the course for UCLA Extension, before I had any books published, I wanted to use a fuller version of that. I mean, I'm sort of more up to date called up Andy and with his permission, went ahead and expanded the table to include, at that point, 15 chronologies. And then said to Andy, why don't we publish this? And Andy said in his typical fashion, do I have to do any work? And I said, well, no. He said, good, let's do it. Actually, he did end up writing a new introduction, so he didn't get out scot-free. But
so that was your first published Sherlockian work?
No, actually it wasn't. The first published Sherlockian work I did was, if you cast your... You're probably too young, Scott, to remember the Prodigy Bulletin Board.
And oh, come on. You're talking a guy who started on a Commodore 64.
Yeah. Okay.
I remember when it was just Commodore 32.
There was an electronics science society called the Wigmore Street Post Office. And I was a member of that group. And somewhere along the line, I got the idea that I would put together a list, because I'm good at things that just require perspiration, not real actual writing talent. So I put together a list of all of the names by which Holmes had been disguised in pastiche. I called it a list of the imposters. And at that point, I mean, it wasn't very complete. Philip Jones has put together this vast bibliography now of pastiches, but I think I had a table that was like 180 different names, like Shylock Bones and Holmlock Shears and all those. And the Wigmore Street Post Office actually published it. Eventually, it ended up as part of George Vandenberg's republication of a volume of the third go-round of Ron DeWall's bibliography. But that was my first Sherlockian publication.
Wow. Wow, that goes way back then.
It really does. Next up was, again, something that came out of my UCLA class, which was that I needed to do, or I wanted to do, a table that was a chronology of Holmes's life, a chronology of Watson's life, chronology of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's life, events in England, events in the world. And I created this massive table, which I was just going to give to my students, ended up publishing that as a self-published item. That ended up going into the Norton volumes eventually. So I plagiarized myself all the time.
So how did you first get into this? When did you encounter Sherlock for the first time?
Not like many Sherlockians. I don't remember reading the stories as a young boy. I was an avid reader, but I was a great science fiction reader. So I probably came across Holmes mentioned in the writings of Paul Anderson and Heinlein and Asimov, all of whom were Sherlockians. But I don't remember reading the stories. When I discovered it was when I was in law school. When I was in my second year of law school, it was 1968, and I received a gift of the Beringold annotated Sherlock Holmes. And I desperately needed recreational reading to go with my law school studies. And I just was absolutely hooked by that book and by the footnotes and by the scholarship and all that. And then I started reading.
Yeah, and then in the Marion Gould book, you learned that there was such a thing as the Baker Street Irregulars.
Right. But all I did about that at that point was I did what I think every budding Sherlockian should do. I subscribed to the journal. And from there,
say that again.
Every budding Sherlockian should subscribe to the Baker Street Journal.
Excellent. At bakerstreetjournal.com.
Yes, indeed. I did that, and it kind of introduced me into the world of these scholars, and it fascinated me. And I began collecting Holmes. I wasn't writing anything. I went to a BSI dinner in the 70s as a guest of Chris Steinbrenner. Probably pissed off Julian Wolfe, I guess, because I never got invited back. But stayed in contact with Sherlockians because I was teaching law courses for a national group, and they were always there was one in New York every year. So I was friends with Mickey Fromkin, Susan Rice, Andy Peck, Henry Enberg, Susan Dollinger, Barbara Ulin, Marlene Egg, that whole sort of New York crowd of Sherlockians went to the Mohonk Mountain House weekend a couple of times. And eventually Andy, who became, he and I became close friends, in the mid 90s, got me invited back to the dinner.
Now, a couple of annotations to that remark, if I may annotate the annotator. The Mohonk Mountain Weekend, that later became known as Autumn in Baker Street, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
I don't know. I didn't know there was a connection. The Mohonk Mountain House Weekend was started originally by Dillis Wynn, who owned the bookstore. Murder, Inc. It was taken over by Carol Brenner, who bought the bookstore and continued the conference. And it was just a lovely 3 or 4 day mystery oriented weekend up at the house. And it had not a lot of Sherlock. It didn't have much Sherlockian content, but there was a core group of Sherlockians.
Okay.
And we all were good friends, or we became good friends. We created the famous, you can ask any of them someday about the famous Freddy the Pig detective team.
I've heard of Freddy the Pig.
That's a long story in itself, but we all became close friends. And that group eventually turned into, it was also Kieran and Billy Palmer. That group turned into the Friends of Bogies. There's lots of sort of offshoots there, but sadly, some of that group is gone. Henry's gone, Marlene Egg is gone. Yulin's gone, but some of us have still around.
Indeed. And one name you mentioned in that list of who's who of Sherlockians from the New York area, sounds like the mafia of Sherlock Holmes, Chris Steinbrenner. Can you tell folks
who's gone, of course, but
who's Chris Steinbrenner for those of us who may not necessarily be familiar with him?
Chris was, occupationally, he was the archivist for RKO Pictures.
Yeah, he was the group film director for WOR,
right.
which was one of the RKO, at the time, RKO General owned a series of television stations, and one of them was WOR, and Chris used to say, "I'll bet you don't know what WOR stands for." And everyone would say no, and he would say, "World of Radio." And Chris was a dear.
That was pretty good.
Thank you. I love an opportunity to do a Chris Steinbrenner impression for somebody who remembers Chris. But Chris was a dear friend, and he had as his objective to view and possibly own every mystery film ever made. And before his sad passing, got quite a ways down that road.
Chris was a reviewer. He wrote Cinema of the Fantastic. He wrote the films of Sherlock Holmes. He was just the sweetest guy. He had a great resemblance to Charles Schulz's character Pigpen. I stayed at Chris's house one night, house was filled with books. I mean, I'm not talking bookshelves. I'm talking books in piles. Yeah, the only way to maneuver the house was to walk among these piles of books.
I stayed at Chris's house once as well, and the piles of books were almost as deep as the pile of dust in the bedroom.
Yes.
Where we stayed, because since when his mother, I think the last time the house was clean was when his mother was still alive.
Yes, I think that's right. But unfortunately, he died in a mugging, a very tragic death. And I'm sorry, that's not right.
No,
he was mugged.
He was mugged, and he had diabetes and became quite ill.
Right, but the mugging, he actually celebrated the mugging for years.
He was so rotund that he was actually stabbed in the mugging. And he was so rotund that the stabbing didn't injure a major organ, and he found this a source of great joy.
Yes. He was just the sweetest guy. He used to come out to L.A. frequently do film courses for UCLA Extension. He was a great historian, and you know, he loved – one of his great ventures was that he put on a Saturday morning theater. He and a friend rented a warehouse space, furnished it with movie seats, and ran B movies on Saturday mornings for free.
That is great.
Yeah. And he was an Edgar winner. I think he won an Edgar for films of Sherlock Holmes, didn't he?
Well, and of course, he also wrote with Steinbrenner. He wrote the Encyclopedia of Mystery and Detection. Before that, the Detectionary.
Right.
He knew his stuff.
With Otto.
Yes.
With Otto, yeah. Yeah, the winner. He's much missed. He's a very dear man.
Do you have your video on? Can you see? This is the pictures. There's a little glare. The top picture is Chris. Believe it or not, the bottom picture is actually Otto Penzler.
Oh, my gosh.
This was published in the 70s, I think. 1976. So... Otto as a trendy 70s, New York hippie type.
Man about town, yes.
Yeah.
We should add that picture to, or a link to that picture if we can, because I can't get...
Yeah, can you scan that in and send me a scan, Les? That'll be great.
Of course. Yeah. Of course, I'll be
excellent
too.
I'd love to see that. Chris was a dear friend and much missed.
Well, I think this notion of... of connection with film will come back later in the conversation. But you did mention as part of your reminiscence of Chris's connection with UCLA. And UCLA, I think, is a topic we'll want to cover in a future episode with you, Les, because there's a big event that's in the planning phases right now at UCLA. Oh. But in the meantime, how does one get to start teaching a course on Sherlock Holmes? How does the university identify a need, and then how does one actually develop a course about Sherlock Holmes?
I think the answer is you do it the way you do most things. You ask them. I had a friend who was the assistant dean of UCLA Extension. It wasn't his area at all. He gave me the name of the dean of, I think, whatever they called it, the arts division. I pitched her. She was a little skeptical. Especially since I hadn't published anything, she gave it a shot. We had a great turnout, and the students were very enthusiastic, and I got very high grades, not because of the content, but just because I was so enthusiastic. So we've repeated the course. The course is given about every 18 months to 2 years. It's not a huge course. I mean, we typically get 30 students. It's a course that covers, it used to be an 18-hour course. Now it's a 6-hour Saturday course. And it covers the life of Holmes. I give them assigned reading ahead of time. I usually play a radio show. I show them film clips. We talk about Holmes. My favorite part of it, of course, is that usually after about the first hour, when I've been talking about Sherlock Holmes was born in the West Country of England, country squires, etc., someone raises their hand and says, excuse me, Professor Klinger. Of course, that's why I teach the course, so I get called professor. excuse me, Professor Klinger, I'm confused. Is Sherlock Holmes real or fictional? And you know what I say.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So
the question
that's kind
you've
of,
been waiting for.
Right. That's kind of the tone for the whole class. And then last year, doing Dracula, and we did that too. We did a separate course called Dracula and His World.
What now? Do you have any guest speakers come in to assist with this, or is this something you tackle on your own? Because I know you don't like to do the heavy lifting, as you said before.
Yeah, right. The answer is I have had guests in the past. Generally not. For Dracula, I had several guests. I was really excited. I got both Gordon Melton... and another professor who was actually writing a thesis about the Twilight books. This was my Dracula course. Sherlock Holmes, I don't know that I've ever had a guest speaker, but what happens is some of the local Sherlockians actually take the course just because they want to sit around for 6 hours and talk about Holmes. It's not a lecture class. It's more of an active participation class in many cases. Don Hobbs, for example... happened to be in town when I taught the course last time, and he came by, and I involved him in discussion.
That's great. You know, I want to pause for a moment here in the show and kind of string together a few things. You mentioned when you were in law school, you were looking for something to do. When you started up this study of Sherlock Holmes, you were bugging your wife for what are we going to do on the weekends? And this course takes place on Saturdays. So I'm thinking this is, you know, what should we do this weekend should be the subtitle of this show.
There you go. Well, you know, I mean, I always say, and I'm very hesitant about my mania because my office, this is my home office. My office is filled with Holmes posters and copies of my books and a lot of other Sherlock Holmes books. And I worry that clients somehow get the impression that I don't practice law full time. So I'm always quick to explain.
Well, wait a minute. I get that impression.
Yeah. Some people play tennis and golf and things like that and have a life outside of the computer. This is what I do.
But this this is a natural extension of what any great lawyer does naturally, which is research and precedent and cataloging and comparison and detail and investigation.
I absolutely agree. So, and I do lots of other things. I love to cook. I love movies. I have certain TV shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, to which I've been addicted. Why are you laughing?
Well, hey, let's talk vampires for a little bit, since that's one of your other major interests. How did that come about? And let's also talk about the Sherlockian connection to vampires too.
Well, the interest in vampires was never really a significant passion up until I wrote this book, because I had read Dracula when I was in law school or in college. And enjoyed it, and bought in the 70s, I bought Leonard Wolf's annotated Dracula, because I like footnotes. And, you know, I always enjoyed that stuff, but I wasn't really a vampire scholar by any means. But what happened was, when the Sherlock Holmes books were done, which was in 2005, I mean, they were done. They were really done. I was done with the galleys. I couldn't do anything more on those books for Norton. And the reference library series was almost done. I hadn't done the Apocrypha, but the Apocrypha is a whole other, that was a lagniappe. That was dessert. We didn't really intend to do that in the beginning. So I was done with Holmes, and a quick immodest aside. I get put on panels at writing conferences to talk about, you know, breaking into writing and how hard it is. And I always say, look, I'm a terrible panelist for this, because the publisher came to me and asked me to write the book. I went to one of the top agents and said, would you be my agent? I already have a publisher. And I won the Edgar for my first real book ever. I win the Edgar. So I'm full of myself at the end of that process saying, boy, I'm obviously some great writer. So what am I going to do next? Because obviously this is the beginning of a whole new, immensely successful and immensely lucrative career. What did I know?
John Grisham Clinger.
Right. So I started thinking about what to do next. And my wife, again, Sharon, actually gets credit. She said, why don't you do Dracula? And I thought about it, and I thought, it's perfect. It's the Victorian era. Dracula really was a contemporary of Holmes. I've already got some expertise in the Victorian period. This will be great fun to do. And I managed to sell it to Norton and dove into it, and there it is.
So let's talk a little bit about the grand game and how this, and perhaps your involvement with BSI Publications overall. Obviously, Mike Whalen, or Wiggins of the BSI, looked at your editing chops, as it were, from the annotated and the reference library, and tapped you to kind of oversee this publishing empire that the BSI was embarking upon. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what it means to be the overall series editor for the history series of the BSI and the manuscript series, and then let's talk a little bit about the grand game in a bit.
Okay, well, the history series and the manuscript, the series editor function is really very different from what Laurie and I are doing with the Grand Game volumes. The series editor function is really an executive function. It's very little. I mean, I did write at some point, I think, a preface to the series, but mainly it was selecting editors and then managing. I mean, riding herd on the editors, supervising the printing process and all that. That was before we actually expanded into now having, as we do, a production team, a sales team and all that. It was back in the earlier days when the BSI publishing was sort of three or four of us. Now it's like 10 of us. So the history series, for example, the current project consists of selecting the editors for the volumes, nudging them along, trying to work with them to make some sort of big high-level decisions about what to include, what to exclude, how to organize the book, and so on. But it's not a lot of hands-on editing. Very different from the Grand Game, where Mike asked Laurie and me to do that. And I think that I don't want to seem immodest, but I think we were good selections for this reason. The Grand Game is all about celebrating a specific brand of Sherlockian scholarship. It's not about scholarship into Doyle's boyhood or the literary sources for The Hound of the Baskervilles or all that. These essays that we tried to collect, and the reason it's two volumes is simply there's just so much wonderful material we just couldn't fit it all into one volume. Each of these volumes is basically 450 pages. The first one goes through 1959, and the second, we're struggling to keep it to that size, is the post-59 materials from all sources, not just the Bickersby Journal, you know, books, non-Sherlockian magazines, everything. So, but the point I'm trying to make is those selections, we focused on essays that play the grand game, the game being working from the assumption that Holmes and Watson really lived, the stories recorded in the canon are true accounts, or most of them are, and approaching the scholarship from that standpoint. Certainly, Laurie has done that in her book of stories about Mary Russell, and my annotated played the game 100%. You won't find any footnotes in there discussing where Conan Doyle got the idea for this story. I don't want to diss that kind of scholarship. It's got its role. It's got its place in it, but it's not my thing. So it made a lot of sense for the two of us to be the ones sort of selecting this kind of scholarship.
So where do you start? I mean, with the breadth of material that you're faced with, and you've seen probably most of the material as you've been working on the annotated. Right. Over the years, how do you begin to select the best of the best?
Well, we didn't rely simply on my tastes and Laurie's tastes. What we did was we composed, let's call them a jury, ended up being eight distinguished scholars in the field. And we asked them to give us a list of their 10 favorite or best, whatever you want to call it, essays. We compiled those lists. What was really interesting, and they were half English, half American scholars. What was really interesting was how little overlap there was on the lists.
Wow.
I then looked at those lists and then actually went back through the bibliographies in my own books and said, well, I think that they've missed this, this, and this. And then Laurie and I sort of reread everything. We'd have a list, for example, for volume one, we probably had a list of maybe 120 candidates, and we ended up having to cut it essentially in half. Same with the second volume. This has been a lot of, and it's been great fun, wonderful fun to reread these essays. Some real gems.
And if folks would like to reread these essays themselves, they can go to bakerstreetjournal.com, where you can find a link to items for sale. And the Grand Game, Volume 1, is there. Do we have an estimated time of arrival for volume two?
I think it'll be late summer, early fall. Certainly, we're hoping for well before the next weekend. We're pretty far along. I mean, we're at the stage now going, oh gosh, do we have to cut this? We're down to about 70 candidates and probably going to have to cut a few more, but we're at the stage now where the hard work begins, which is the production side. There's a lot of scanning, typesetting to be done, but the editorial part is pretty much done.
Les, the grand game starts with Ronald Knox, Studies in the Literature of Sherlock Holmes. So where are you?
No, it doesn't. The grand game starts
with... But I'm holding it in my hand, Les.
Well, the book opens with that essay, but the grand game itself, the scholarship, starts with three essays that appeared in 1902.
Ah.
A magical year for some particular reason. A man named Frank Sidgwick wrote one. A man named J.B. McKenzie, a Canadian Sherlockian, wrote one.
And
Arthur Bartlett Maurice, writing for the American Bookman magazine, wrote one. Yeah. And those really were the start of the game.
Right. And all those are in the grand game, a celebration of Sherlockian scholarship. But where do you come out on this current debate around Knox as the originator or progenitor of all of this?
There are things to be said on both sides, and I don't know that it makes a lot of difference. I mean, Knox laid out some structure, some thinking. He certainly stimulated some thinking, but the game didn't really take off until the late 20s, early 30s. It's pretty clear that those writers, S.C. Roberts, Dorothy Sayers, et cetera, knew Knox's essay and saw themselves as picking up the torch from where it had fallen after he wrote his essay and nobody did anything with it. Mm. But it doesn't really matter. But I'm not sure what the crown is all about here. Who started the grand game? Who founded it? Who theorized it? Certainly the principles were laid down by Knox, but nothing happened really for a long time after that essay, almost years. Mm.
I think it's because everybody was busy those weekends.
There were little things like World War I and the
Roaring Twenties.
Yeah, but hey, has that ever stopped Sherlockians?
So when you and Laurie were pulling together volume one, what of this material were you encountering for the first time, and what was your reaction to it? Had you read Roberts before? Had you read these other things before?
Yeah, there was nothing in that volume that I hadn't read before, but it was a great pleasure to reread. It was extremely difficult to say, we can't use this piece or that piece. There's just such wonderful quality material. I mean, people like to say, however, and I do want to put in a plug for volume two. There's a lot of people who think, there was the golden age of Sherlockian scholarship, the 30s, maybe the 40s, and then the 50s, it was getting a little weak and all that. Baloney. There is still, we have some quality material from last year that's going to be in this volume, and the year before that, and the year before that. There has not been any drop-off in quality since the so-called golden age. It's harder to find fresh topics, but it's not hard to find fresh approaches to even some of the old topics. I mean, for example, and I don't mean to pick on Laurie, but she gave a talk which turned into a paper, which is going to be in volume, which was, to me, finally, the compelling answer to why Dr. Watson's wound is in his leg and his shoulders. It's hardly a fresh topic, but that paper was written in 2007.
Yeah, that was great. I remember that from the BSI Distinguished Speaker lecture. It was great. Now, since you did read all this stuff already, Les, Let's ask the question a different way. Is there one particular piece of Sherlockian scholarship that continually stands out in your mind, or that you just find is so fun that you like to return to time and again?
Well, yeah, there are a couple that I'm really fond of. One of them is a piece by Peter Blau, a wonderful piece studying the question of studying the blue carbuncle, which winds up rejecting the whole discussion of whether a goose has a crop, where, if you recall the story, the gem has been found in the crop of the goose. Peter cuts through the Gordian knot and points out that this was clearly a typographical error in which an O was mistaken for an A.
So he cuts through the crap, really. Yeah,
really. Well, this is radio. We can't say that. That's
right. This is the internet. We can say anything, and no one will find out.
But no, I mean, you know, in terms of the books that I mean, one of the things that we've tried to do in this volume is also include excerpts or little tastes from some of the wonderful books that have been published, not just articles, but books. So, for example, we have a couple of excerpts from Martin Dakin's Sherlock Holmes casebook, cuts from all kinds of other things. I mean, the essays that William Beringold wrote as introductory essays for his annotated Sherlock Holmes. This is wonderful material.
Well, and it's now, this may be the first time that all of this has been brought together in one place, particularly the S.C. Roberts, as well as the Knox, as well as the early things from 1902. It's an amazing gathering.
I think it is the first time that they've all been sort of under one roof, and I hope it will cause people to say, boy, this stuff is pretty good. Yeah. Maybe I should read more.
And including that great Sherlockian scholar, Zazu Pitts.
Indeed. We did point out, of course, in our introduction that she didn't really write the piece, but it's got her byline, so.
It's a start. So speaking of starting, for the budding Sherlockian, and I know we've got an audio comment coming up later in the show from a listener who just started reading the stories and discovered the show. Where would you recommend the budding Sherlockian to start with regard to kind of this ex parte literature?
It used to be that my answer was start with Beringold's annotated. Today I would be self-serving and say start with my new annotated, because you get the spectrum of Sherlockian scholarship. What I tried really hard to do in my footnotes was to show the diversity of views on the classical issues. But for a single book, Steve Doyle's Sherlock Holmes for Dummies, Chris Redman's Sherlock Holmes Handbook, the old Michael and Molly Hardwick Sherlock Holmes Companion, these are wonderful sort of single volume introductions to the classical problems, in a way that doesn't drive you crazy by looking at footnotes.
Now, I'll throw you a softball here. You obviously did a lot of annotating, a lot of reference work for both the annotated and the Sherlock Holmes Reference Library, published by Wessex Press. What's the difference between the two for the novice?
Well, I guess it can be summed up simply this way. A friend of mine looked at the reference library, one of the volumes, and said, "Ah, I see your writing style, Les. It's law review." What they meant was, you see these pages where there is one line of text and 20 more lines of footnote. It's academic in the sense that one of the things I did in the reference library was I quoted extensively from secondary sources. And when it came to the Norton series, Norton wanted me to rewrite everything and basically put it, I thought it was going to be a snap to do, but then they wanted me to rewrite everything and put it in my own words. So there's much, much, much less quoting from other sources. There's lots of references to other sources, but it'll be a paraphrase that instead of including three paragraphs from what Dakin said about something, I'll say in one sentence a summary of what Dakin said. So the reference library is really much more academic. In addition, the Norton series has more material about the Victorian age. The editors at Norton wanted me to include more material that was sort of background to the cultural aspects, the historical aspects, and so we put that in. And then there's one more difference that I'm really extremely proud of, and that is that the Norton edition is clearly the most heavily illustrated edition of the canon that's ever been published. There are over 1,000 illustrations in the 3 volumes. Wow. And in many respects, they are far superior to the Baring Gould illustrations, not because I'm a better hunter of photographs, but because technology has improved so that the scans of the Strand Magazine illustrations, the Doerr-Steele illustrations, etc., are just technologically superior. They're much clearer and brighter than the old scans. So The pictures in the Norton edition are worth the price alone.
You're the driving force behind the new annotated as well as the reference library, and now you and Laurie have done the grand game. So if somebody were to say to you, Les, surely everything that's been said about Sherlock Holmes has now been said. There's nothing left. What would your response to that be?
Nonsense. Absolute nonsense. I'm already looking forward to having the vigor to write the new annotated Sherlock Holmes 20 years from now, incorporating the what will then be 25 years of scholarship that will have come out in the interim. There is great stuff being published every day in quality magazines like the Baker Street Journal, the Sydney Passenger's Log, the Sherlock Holmes Journal, Canadian Holmes, Prescott's Press. I could go on and on. There's still great scholarship being written, and somebody doing what I did 20 years from now is going to add a lot more material.
Hey, Les, you want a real moneymaker idea? I'll give it to you right here. Make an iPad app of just annotations that you can open as you've actually got your book in front of you.
I thought you were going to say pocket parts, which is a thing that in the legal biz, you know, you put out Klinger on contracts, and then for the rest of your life, you sell a supplement that they put in the back of the book, in a little pocket in the back, that so you don't have to come out with a new edition. You just keep updating it. The electronic idea, Scott, is a fascinating one. Norton has the right to make the decision about that. I'd like to see it happen, but I don't know that it's soon. It's pretty expensive to convert this into hyperlinks, which is what we'd like to do. It's not. I won't rule it out.
Well, I want 10%.
You just gave it away.
Hey, you're talking to a lawyer. Do you really expect that you could give me an idea and then claim you get paid?
It's already filed. So we were talking earlier, Les, about Dracula. But one of the things that we didn't touch on there was, the idea of the crossover. Have you paid any attention to those kinds of crossover experiences? Sherlock Holmes meets Dracula, Sherlock Holmes and H.G. Wells and all this stuff?
Absolutely. So I have, in the annotated Dracula, there is, first of all, in the annotated Sherlock Holmes, there is a brief discussion of pastiche, not a very deep discussion of pastiche. Pastiche meaning stories about Holmes involving things that aren't in the canon. Obviously, there is no story in the canon about Sherlock Holmes meeting Dracula, but there could be. So in the annotated Dracula, I have a long note, and maybe 3 or 4 pages discussing at least a half dozen different Holmes meets Dracula, and I do love them. I'm very fond of Kim Newman's Anno Dracula, in which Mycroft is a significant character. Sherlock has actually been put into a concentration camp by Dracula himself, who's taken over the British government. It's a wonderful, actually a series of novels, but the first one is called Anno Dracula. The author is Kim Newman. There's Fred Saberhagen's book about Holmes and Dracula. Dan Stashower did The Adventure of the Ectoplasm. No, I'm sorry, The Adventure of the Sanguinary Count. There's others. But and now there's comics. There's some great comic books. There are my friend Martin Powell did Scarlet in Gaslight back in the 70s, which was a black and white crossover. There's a new series now, Victorian Undead, by Ian Edginton, being published by Dynamite. And, no, I'm sorry, by Wildstorm. And the latest story arc of that book is Sherlock Holmes versus Dracula. I've been fortunate. I've actually been, quote, consulting on that project and some related projects. So consulting means I get to read the script and say, wow, this is really great.
So have you ever thought about fiction? Would you ever write your own pastiche?
I wrote one pastiche in my life. I wrote it, actually wrote it probably 40 years ago, and then about 15 years ago, found it tucked away in a drawer and said, boy, that's garbage. I need to fix that a lot. Edited it, sold it to Otto Penzler. You may not remember that Otto was publishing a series of pamphlets for a while that he was alternating classic and new pastiche. He bought the story from me. It's called The Adventure of the Wooden Box. It's available on Amazon as a Kindle download. And I've thought about, we haven't really talked about this anthology that Laurie and I are doing called A Study in Sherlock, which is, the subtitle is Stories Inspired by the Sherlock Holmes Canon. I had the idea, and Laurie embraced it, that we would go to our friends, major mystery writers, and, well, not all mystery writers either, and say to them, would you like to write a story about Sherlock Holmes or a character that's inspired by Sherlock Holmes or one of the minor characters or whatever? 17 of them said, we would love to do that. So we have Laura Lippman, Neil Gaiman, Lee Child, Michael Durda, on and on, an incredible list, who are writing these stories. The book will be out in December, published by Random House. And we looked at it, and Laurie and I both had originally thought we were going to write stories ourselves. That's how I got to this subject. Decided that we didn't need to. We had such great quality stuff. Random House is jumping up and down with excitement over the list of authors that we got to write stories. None of them, with the exception of Neil Gaiman, none of them sort of publicly associated with Holmes. But all great fans. Jan Burke, Margaret Maron, Jackie Winspear, Gail Linz, and so on. But we're hoping that this book will do so well that we'll get to do a second volume. And if we do a second volume, I think Laurie and I will both contribute stories. And I've started to think about that. But I don't really see myself as a fiction writer. That takes actual talent.
Wow. My brain's full after that. I don't know about you.
Yeah, my brain is full too. It's incredible. And we haven't even gotten to a subject that I think a lot of our listeners are going to be very interested in, which is Les's work on the Robert Downey Jr. pictures.
Indeed. That'll be a fascinating discussion. We hope you'll be able to join us in the next episode as Les continues the conversation about that. But now, I think we have something very special, something we haven't had in a while, and we're honored to have it this time, and that is a listener comment in the form of an audio call.
Hi, this is Brandon from South Carolina. I'm 27 years old. I've only been reading Sherlock Holmes stories for a few months now, but I just love them very much, and I just discovered your podcast recently, and I think it's a great way to find out what other Sherlock Holmes fans are into. And I've just learned a lot about the Sherlock Holmes fan community through your show, and I just wanted to express my appreciation. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Brandon. It's we really appreciate the call and the comment and the feedback. And I don't know, you know, you come across people like Brandon who are discovering the Holmes stories for the first time and all of the attendant craziness around it. And it's hard not to feel envy, you know, to be able to encounter all this stuff.
Yeah.
New is, boy, what a treat.
Yeah, you know, Les talked about discovering the stories and the annotated, the Baring Gould annotated in his law school days. I remember, and I believe we've talked about it here before, of you know, when I discovered kind of the last few stories in the collection and the annotated when I was in college myself. And there's just a certain feeling about, you know, just a wow factor that, you know, you can never recapture. And it's a time of wonderment. When we knew so little about the character and about the world of Sherlock Holmes, but were completely blown away by it. What a great feeling. And I hope we can continue to bring our listeners a certain kind of feeling. I won't say what that is. But a certain kind of feeling by doing what we're doing. And tell us how it's reaching you. You know, are you affected by this? Does it matter? And you can do so in a number of ways. You can do what Brandon did by giving us a call at 774-221-READ. That's 774-221-7323. Mm-hmm. You can, go ahead.
You can leave a comment at IHearOfSherlock.com or on our Facebook page.
We love Facebook. You'll see us posting regularly. Our episodes will actually be not only posted to the website, IHearOfSherlock.com, but they'll be automatically posted on Facebook as well. So you have no excuse for not being updated as to the latest in our show cadence, which we hope to continue on a regular basis in 2011. We've let you down a little bit in the last year or two, but we really hope to reinvigorate that cadence this year. Again, thanks in part to our great sponsors at Wes Express, and thanks to the amazing amount of material out there on Sherlock Holmes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that means we've come to the end of the first installment of our chat with Les Klinger. And probably the only thing left to say is I'm Bert Wolder.
And I'm Scott Monty. And until next time,
the game's afoot.
I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.